The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 329 for Monday, May 9th, 2011.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, you send in your tips. We do our best to answer your questions, share your tips, share our tips, and in general, all learn something about the Mac and Apple. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
Hi, John. How are you?
Fantastic.
That's good. That's good. I'm trying to think if we have anything crazy to report, but I don't think we do. I think we have, well, I know what we have. What's crazy to report is the amount of questions that we got this week. So we're almost certainly not going to get to all of them, but we're going to do our darndest here. Anything to mention before we head right into all that good stuff, John?
Well, we got something to mention. Should we leave it to the end? I mean, you know what?
Oh yeah. Leave that till the end. Yeah. Good stuff. That's right. Yeah. Other than that,
we're on a high pollen alert.
Yeah.
High tree pollen alert.
Yeah. Tell me about it. I allergies don't usually bother me, but if you're a regular listener to the show, you can probably tell I'm a little gravelly today. And that's that's your high pollen there. But we're going to do our best to ignore that at least as long as possible. Before we get into, we've got a couple things about security, a security question, and then actually a question about malware. But before we get into that, I do want to talk about our first sponsor for the show, which is Barebones Software at barebones.com. And today we are talking about Yojimbo. Yojimbo is a piece of software that organizes everything else on your computer. And by everything else, what I mean are all those bits and pieces of information that don't otherwise have a home. You've got your, iCal or BusyCal, your calendar holds your schedule and your to-dos. Your mail program holds all your email. But what about all these little snippets of information that you get? The little maybe serial numbers and, little tech tips and maybe recipes and just all that general data that maybe is in different formats. Maybe some of it's text, maybe some of it's pictures, maybe some of it's PDFs, but you have no one place where you can pour it all together other than just stuffing it into a folder in your Finder. And that works okay, but it's certainly not going to help you. Well, that's where Yojimbo comes in. Yojimbo lets you pump all that information into one program, one place. And of course you can create what they call collections, which are just, folders of data. Of course, the same piece of data can actually be in two collections. So that's kind of cool. And I use it to manage all the questions you folks send in and all the audio files and all that stuff that we use to build the show. But of course, I store everything else in it, and you can do the same. It's available in two places, barebones.com and also at the Mac App Store. It's $39, save a penny. And you can get it there. So barebones.com or the Mac App Store, and it is $39. If you are a student, you can get it from the website, barebones.com, for $10 less, $29. So check that out. It of course comes as a free trial. So that's the first thing you want to do is try it out, see how you like it. And then once you're hooked, pull the trigger and off you go. That's from barebones.com. And with that, John, let's dive in and see what Patrick has to say. Patrick writes, I read an article on several websites about how easy it is to change the admin password or really any user password on a Mac. All you have to do is boot into single user mode, holding down Command S, and then mount the drive in read-write mode, where the instructions are write in single user mode. And after that, use the Unix PASSWD command to change the password for any user on the system. I have to say that I'm scared. I was a PC guy who switched to the Mac. Is that a bad move? What are your thoughts on this? Please respond. John?
I'm going to start it off.
Okay.
With maybe a philosophical thing, and then I'm going to get down to some facts.
Okay.
So philosophical, though I'm going to add a caveat to it, but philosophically, if someone has physical access to your machine and they can even get it into single user mode, which you can really only do if you have access to the keyboard,
right?
Then I would say you may have bigger problems than, well,
that's true. Actually, at single user mode, you have more access to the data on that computer than you do even if you're booted up as an administrator.
Yeah, so it's a mode that can come in handy for a number of things, which, you know, we've touched on in the past. So that's kind of the bad news. But then here's the good news, Dave.
What's that?
Well, you may be asking yourself, well, is there a way I could prevent someone from activating single user mode on my Mac? And the good news is that there is.
Really? How is that?
I'm going to tell you. And it's in one of these wonderful Apple
knowledge base
articles, yeah. HT1352, and it's called setting up firmware password protection in Mac OS X.
Right.
Okay. And what this does, so this, in a nutshell, limits what one can do when they start up the machine. And fortunately, and there's a nice little checklist, so, you know, I'm not going to read the entire article to you, but if you check out the article, among the things it will block is, and the item is right here, block the ability to start up a system in single user mode by pressing the Command S key during startup. So, and there are a number of other things it blocks. So I'm not going to read them all, but, you know, it can prevent starting up from optical disk, which that may be another way someone could attack your system.
Yep.
It'll prevent diagnostics, target disk mode, a lot of things that you can use to trick the machine.
Right.
So I wrote back, and that was my first answer is, you know, if you're concerned about this, then that is one thing that you want to do. And that you should be able to do on any modern Mac and even back to the PowerPC Macs.
That's right. Yeah.
So that's one thing you can do. Now, however, I'm going to repeat what I said. Physical access. If somebody has physical access to your machine, well, if they can get in a single user mode, you know what they could probably do? They could just crack open your machine and take your hard drive. Well, now what are you going to do? Because then, you know, it doesn't matter if you have a firmware password, because
it doesn't matter if you have any password.
There's no firmware anymore.
That's right.
Because the person has your drive. And in that case, I would say, in general, you lose.
Well, unless, right?
Unless, and this was the second thing that I mentioned to him. So if you don't take steps to encrypt the contents of your drive, then yes, you lose. This open firmware will not guard against it if someone rips the drive out of your machine. But there are a number of things you could do. Now, one is built into Mac OS X. It's somewhat limited, but it's File Vault. And that you find in System Preferences, Security, File Vault. And that will encrypt the contents of your home directory. So that's why I say it's limited. It doesn't encrypt everything. But there are a few other tools. So that's the one that Apple gives you for free. It's built in OS X. So if you're concerned about people stealing your data, then enable that by all means.
Right.
There are a few other options. One is something that I wrote about a little while ago called TrueCrypt. Now, TrueCrypt on the Mac does not work on boot volumes, but you may want to consider keeping your sensitive data on an external drive and then using TrueCrypt or the other product, which I believe Pilot Pete uses.
That's right. PGP whole disk encryption, which does the same thing as TrueCrypt in that it compresses it, or it encrypts a disk, but it will work on your boot disk. And that, you know, with Pete, he travels a ton and he's well aware that if someone gets his computer, they have his hard drive, you know, outside of that computer if they want it. And he has some data on there. He'd rather not get into anyone else's hands, you know, maybe personal, you know, checking accounts or banking data or anything like that. And so he encrypts his drive and he feels safe with that. And he is safe with that because the way these things encrypt, it's not just the password isn't the lock that opens the door. It is the key to being able to decrypt the data. So you can't even begin to decrypt the data without the password. It is integral to the way it is encrypted. So it's good stuff. Yeah.
Right.
John?
The only potential downside of any of these solutions is that there may be a performance hit while it's doing the encrypting and decrypting, but
right. That's right.
I'd say you got to weigh performance versus the security of your data.
Yeah. Well, and that, you know, as we were going through this question and as you were answering your part, I wrote something down here to remember to say it. And I wrote convenience versus safety. And this is true with just about any time you're worried about safety or security or anything, be it your computer or your house or your car or whatever. You know, is it more convenient for me to leave my car door unlocked and my key inside the car? Yes. Is that safe? No. Well, in a general sense, yeah, it is. I mean, I haven't ever had it cause me a problem, but if someone were to get to my car, then they could get in and take off, right? I mean, there's nothing stopping them other than perhaps, you know, their morals or someone yelling at them. But, you know, the same is true with your computer. How many hoops do you want to force a would-be, you know, attacker to jump through? And those are the same hoops you need to jump through, right? You know the answers going in, of course. And hopefully the person trying to break into the computer doesn't, but it does require, you know, you to do that. The same with your iPhone. If you put a passcode lock on it, makes it more secure, makes it less convenient. So it's convenience versus security. That's exactly the way I look at it. Yeah. All right. Kevin sent us a question about something that we saw pop up in the last week here. Very, very interesting how this has, well, we'll let Kevin start us out.
Hey, Mac Geeks, John, Dave, and Pilot Pete. How's it going? It's Kevin here from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, a longtime listener of the show. And I have something for the not-so-cool things found category. I work at a local computer tech shop, and I might mention that part of my inspiration for that has been listening to the show over the years. So
that's
anyways,
awesome.
Thanks for that. But so I had a Mac come in with malware on it, which I Google searched, and it seems pretty legitimately malware. It's called Mac Defender. I don't know if you've heard of it. But it's basically one of those, you know, pretending to be an antivirus protect you program that wants your Visa number to pay them. And yeah, so not cool. So my question is, what do you guys recommend for removing this sort of thing? I know we see this on Windows all the time, and we have a lot of tools for scanning and removing, you know, anything in the registry and whatever that might be infected. But in OS X, I'm not so sure when I started thinking about it, you know, what this program might get into. Actually, I found a cool article on Mac Fix It that kind of talks about how to remove it, but I could link to that. But I wanted to see what you guys thought, you know. I was thinking of using like an application deletion program, and like the one I use is App Cleaner, something like that. But I'm worried that when somebody writes software that's bad, that what else it might be doing that we don't know about. So, you know, of course we can check Activity Monitor and run Onyx and maybe check in the console and stuff like that. But I wanted to see if you guys had some more ideas as to how to get rid of this thing, short of doing like a whole OS in reinstall, which is at this point actually what I'm kind of recommending for the client, just to make sure. But yeah, so not so cool stuff found here. Mac, it's called Mac Defender malware, and it's all over the web if you Google search it.
Yep. All right. Thanks, Kevin. So yeah, I did hear about this, and essentially I didn't get it. So I can't speak firsthand, but from what I understand, John, this is it's something that we came up when people were browsing images in Google image search, and it would automatically download. It would start sending you this file that then launched an application. And it did this using Safari's open safe files command or setting, which I guess is under, if you go into Safari Preferences General, there is a checkbox at the bottom that says open safe files after downloading. And so it was this, I believe it was a disk image that it was opening up, and then the disk image kind of had a graphic in it that said you need to install me because you have this this virus or something along those lines. So it's an interesting type of attack. You know, it's not a virus, right, John? I mean, this is, I think malware is the right term to use. Yeah.
To me, a virus is something that propagates without any user intervention over a network. And some people may shake their fist saying that. But that's how I would classify a virus versus malware, which to me is something where the user has to take some action.
Yep.
Usually through trickery, which is what's happening here, to install it. And I think, what happens is what appears to be a legitimate Mac OS X installer comes up saying, oh, hi, I'm installing, and it sounds like something good.
Right.
To me, though, the first thing you should think about is, wait a second, I didn't ask for this to happen.
Right.
And that, to me, that would be the first piece of advice. I think what he's asking is, by that point, I think it's too late. Maybe we could entertain that, but I would say the absolute first thing is, if you all of a sudden see an installer start running and you did not explicitly download something, I would add to it from a trusted site. I would say Mac Update, is one. But if you didn't instigate this, then don't go any further. Quit. So be careful.
Yeah.
That would be my first reaction. If all of a sudden I saw something saying Mac Defender start to install itself or ask for my permission, I'd be like, no.
No. That's right. It's interesting. And there's an article, I guess it was the nextweb.com that was the first place I saw this news. And it's interesting. I mean, they say to look in library startup items and then library launch agents and library launch daemons for references to the app and pull them out of there. I have no doubt that, Intigo and Symantec are going to be right there and saying that this is the reason we need to all have antivirus and anti-malware software on our Macs. I'm still not running anything on mine. And the reason for that is not just being cavalier and saying, there's never any problems with the Mac. And this really is the first one of these that we've ever seen in the wild, to my knowledge. I think it's, we've certainly seen people create them in the lab, but I believe this is the first one we've seen in the wild. And it did give me pause. It was like, oh no, do I have to start running virus protection software? And the problem is with that stuff, after having used it on Windows and helped people with it on Windows, is by definition, virus protection software gets in your way. It at the very least, it has to scan every app and every document that you are going to open. Right. And so that slows things down. It has to slow things down. Right. If you say, I open that file, and the first thing that happens is you've got some software running in memory that says, oh, let me see that first. Okay, yeah, it's good. You're good to go. They can make it as efficient as they want. It's still going to slow you down. And so that's kind of my big problem with it is machines not running virus protection software just run so much faster. Now, of course, if you live in a world like the Windows world, where if you don't run any of this, you're doomed and your machine's going to slow down because you're going to have all sorts of spyware and everything. Well, then, you've got to pick the lesser of two evils. And at that point, it's virus protection software. But this isn't enough to make me start running it, but it is enough to remind me and perhaps remind all of you just what John said, question anything that seems to pop up out of the ordinary. Google it, if something seems out of place, send it up to Google. See what the rest of the world's saying. Chances are somebody else is seeing the same thing or has seen it if it's legit. And if it's not, you might get the same deal. Hey, how about you, John? You going to install virus software?
No, because I've had the same experience with you. They, by their nature, have to get rather intimate with the file system. And they have to, as you said, get in your way.
Right.
And I remember, I don't remember the exact name, but it was one of the shows that I went to recently, and they came out with a new Mac antivirus, or so they claim. They said, oh, well, it's free. There's no problem. Try it out.
Right.
I went home that night, downloaded it, tried it out. Crash.
that's even worse. Wow.
And it was a newly released product. And like, there's no harm in using it. Just run it and see what you think. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll dig around and see if I can find it, but it may not even be around anymore. But again, by its nature, and apparently they didn't test it thoroughly because I couldn't even run it the first time. It wasn't even able to get its job done. So for now, I'm with you. But be vigilant.
Yeah. Vigilant, you mean?
Or vigilant.
Yeah.
Vigilant?
I'm not sure what vigilant means. that I'm pretty sure it's like being vigilant and diligent at the same time. Digilant. Never mind. Okay. You know, I was perusing the Mac Geek Gab forums over there on TMO this week, and I came across Lee, who asked, is it possible to turn off the automatic running of rules on incoming mail in Mail app? I would like to have all of my incoming mail remain in my inbox until I hit the keystroke for apply rules to file it away in another mailbox. Right now I can do automatic filing with rules, but the rules are applied upon receipt, so I never see those messages in my inbox. And I don't want to have to hunt for them among my many mailboxes. If I want to see a message in my inbox, then I can't have it moved by a rule and I have to file it manually, which is a lot of dragging and the time adds up. If I could make rules for the majority of my list contacts, etc., but apply them only manually, then I'd be able to run through my inbox much more quickly, filing anything that I don't have to deal with and leaving anything that needs my attention. The documentation that I found says that rules run automatically on incoming messages, and I don't see a way to turn that off. It seems like there should be a switch somewhere, but I don't see it. You know, when you put it that way, Lee, it makes sense. There should be a switch somewhere, but there's not. I have a similar issue where, you know, there's messages I want to see and then I just want to file them quickly. And mail's rules, of course, don't let you turn them off. So the way I do this is I use a piece of software called Mail Acton, and it's from indev.ca. And we'll put a link in the show notes, of course. What this does is it lets you assign keystrokes to specific rules or even rule sets in mail. And so you can have these rules all defined or these actions all defined, I guess. And actually they can be rules because it can do things conditionally. So it really allows you to manually trigger any single rule or group of rules, depending on how you configure it. And it works out really, really well. If I have something I need to file to, you know, our Geek Gab folder, I hit Control G and boom, it sends that off to my Geek Gab folder. And if any of you out there thought of the system bell when I said Control G, that's cool because that's back to our Apple II days and actually just ANSI stuff, right? But anyway, it's the answer for you here. And it's one of those things that, you know, I install it immediately upon setting up my Mac and I forget it's there. I forget that it's an add-on because it's so handy. I just use it constantly. I don't have to move my hand off the keyboard. If I'm just scrolling through messages, I'm not dragging with the mouse and trying to, you know, find where to put the thing. It just, boom, it goes right where I want it to go. There's no mistakes and it works great. So Mail Acton's your answer there. And do you use Mail Acton, John? Have you tried that one yet? No, huh?
No, the only add-on I use is SpamSieve.
Oh, yeah.
And it requires you to set up a rule, and actually it likes to be one of the first rules.
Right. Right. Yeah, because otherwise it can't do its thing efficiently. Mm-hmm. All right. I want to talk about our second sponsor for this show, John, which is a returning sponsor to Geek Gab, to Mac Geek Gab, and that is Gazelle.com. I love Gazelle because it's one of those websites where I can actually lose a lot of time and think that I'm going to make money. And then actually I do. Gazelle will buy your old electronics that you're no longer using. That old, you know, iBook that you've got, the old MacBook Pro, the old iPhone, the old iPods, all that stuff and more, old different kinds of cell phones and stuff. It's fantastic. And it saves you the trouble of having to, you know, put it on eBay and sell it. Visit gazelle.com and just start typing in stuff. You know, there's no reason that you don't have to agree. You just type in stuff and, you know, start looking and they'll tell you, they ask you some questions. They'll say, okay, you know, this iPod or iPhone that you're going to sell, does it work? Yes. Does it have water damage? No. You know, does it come with the power connector or not? You know, and you answer all these questions and then it asks what kind of condition it's in. And that's subjective, certainly. And of course, the dollar amount that they'll give you for it is higher based on higher condition. But here's how it works. You agree and you say, okay, yep, I've given you all this criteria and I think it's in, you know, superb condition or good condition. And And they'll say, okay, here's your price. And then they send you a box and you send your iPhone to them. It hasn't cost you anything. And it gets there, and let's say they decide, oh, you know, this isn't superb. It's only good, or it's not good. It's fair. And they'll send you an email with an updated quote. At that point, your decision is to either take the new quote, or if you don't like that number, just tell them to send it back, and you're still out nothing. So, it's a cool service. They've been around for about 5 years. They were founded in 2006, and they say they've had, over 175,000 customers so far. I've sold some stuff through them. I think, did you sell some when they were sponsors the last time around, did you sell anything through them too, John, when we were talking about it, or no?
I had something, but at the point I looked at them, they were not, I think it was an old DVD drive.
Okay.
At that point, they were not accepting DVD drives.
Got it. Okay. But they can,
maybe they are now. I don't know.
They'll pay you by check, Amazon or Walmart gift cards, or even PayPal. And they say that you get a 5% bonus if you do an Amazon gift card. So it's pretty cool. And again, it's just a fun website. I go there sometimes, even if I don't think I'm going to sell anything, I just go there to check and see, you know, if I wanted to get rid of my MacBook Pro really easily without having to, you know, put it on eBay or mention on the show or anything, you know, what could I get for it tomorrow without any work at all? You know, and then they'll just, the number's right there. It's awesome. It's great. So Gazelle.com, and we appreciate their sponsorship, and we're glad to have them back. Moving on to Jeff. John, Jeff has an interesting question. Jeff writes, I can hear an internal disk spin down, and after a few seconds spin back up, and after a few minutes again cycle through the process. I've tried various configurations of system preferences without success. I've gone into Energy Saver, I've tried sharing, I've eliminated startup items, scripts, timed events, etc., all without a change in behavior. The entire system seems to function okay for now, but I'm thinking that this is causing excessive and unnecessary wear and tear, and disaster may loom in my future. I do have a backup system that works and is active. I have a Mac Pro. It's a Mac Pro dual core with 6 gigs of RAM and a 500 gig hard drive in bay one as my system disk. And I'm currently running Snow Leopard 10.6.7. I then have 3 additional 500 gig hard drives in bays 2, 3, and 4. Is there a console log or any built-in reporting system or third-party utility that tracks this kind of disk behavior? And John, I think you have a good starting point for us.
I have an answer. So one, I think where he's looking is in Energy Saver, there's a checkbox saying put the hard disk to sleep when possible. So we're going to assume that he unchecked that.
Okay.
The drive is still making a racket. I had this happen when I upgraded the hard drive in my MacBook Pro, and it started bugging me. It really got to my OCD in that I would be sitting there, you know, sometimes, you know, I'd be, you know, in bed, you know, using a laptop, and I hear this little chunk, 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 chunk. Very silent, but it should have been silent. The drive should have been silent.
Right. And there was nothing wrong with the drive, right? It was just doing what it was supposed to do.
Well, the prior drive didn't do it. So I think because even though it was a class of drive, it was basically a larger version of the same class of drive that the machine originally came with. I think because it was different. And I'll tell you what I found. So I looked on this problem. I certainly was not the only one that was being aggravated by what I think basically was the drive parking the head and then unparking it or spinning up and spinning down. I think it was parking the head, but it was some sort of power management. And what I found was a utility.
Oh, so a power management not controlled by the system, but built into the drive's own electronics.
Right.
Okay.
Because what I found is a program called HDAPM. I'm going to guess HD is for hard drive, and APM, maybe advanced power management.
That would have been my guess.
But it's a small little command line utility that lets you, but this is a parameter, which I do not believe OS X sets normally. I think it just lets the drive do whatever it's set up to do.
Okay.
Which if the drive by default is set for aggressive power management, then you may, and it sounds like that's what's happening. In this case. So what this lets you do, so it's a command line utility. You have to install a small plist file in one of your directories to run it, and it runs it on startup. And what I do is send a parameter saying set to maximum performance. In other words, do not do any power saving. So although it may be somewhat wasteful, it prevents the drive from doing doing the hustle or whatever the drive is doing, doing this power management tango that creates this racket. So I'm going to suspect, so as long as it's an ATA drive,
okay,
an ATA or SATA drive, then this should work because it appears to be a somewhat standard command among ATA and SATA hard drives.
That makes sense. Okay.
That would be my suggestion. So yeah, it's going to waste a little energy, but it will not make a racket. Cause I would agree that, you know, the more physical activity, could make the drive wear out quicker.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you with me on that?
I am with you. Yeah. You know, that whole spin down, spin up thing, it's definitely causing, you know, extra wear and tear in there. I think so for sure. You know, is it causing enough to break it? Well, do you want to find out? Especially if it's like you were describing, John, or like Jeff describes, where it's spinning down and spinning right back up again. Clearly the drive is trying to, you know, do its best to anticipate when it won't be needed, but it sounds like it's needed right away. And so it has to spin right back up, and that's not helping anybody. If it could be off for, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes or longer, but then yeah, absolutely spin it down. But otherwise, you know, that's crazy. That's my feeling. Moving on to James. James has...
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Okay, so James writes, at my work, we use a VPN client that has to be run 32-bit mode on my Mac in order for it to work. As I'm sure you're well aware, the latest MacBook Pros come with the OS booting into the 64-bit kernel as the default, and they do, that's true. So we have to run a command in the terminal in order to force the Mac into 32-bit mode permanently. How does this affect the performance of the machine, that is, booting into 32-bit mode versus 64-bit? I've been told that it mostly doesn't, and that any programs that can run in 64-bit mode will still do so. Also, how does this affect memory over 4 gigabytes? Please help me understand the difference between the two modes, as I'm very confused. John?
I'll kick things off here. Now, I can understand how you could be confused because
it is confusing.
Because this 32-bit versus 64-bit thing is present in multiple parts of the system, and he touches on them. So let's go through them, and let's start at the beginning.
Okay.
With the kernel.
Okay.
So when he's mentioning a 32-bit kernel versus a 64-bit kernel, this is one portion of the system which could be either or. And as he's indicating, and specifically what he's talking about is kernel extensions. There are some kernel extensions. Well, all of them are 32-bit, as far as I know, at least, you know, the ones that come with the OS. And then as the OS started becoming more 64-bit friendly, including a 64-bit kernel,
yep,
what software vendors would have to do, or hardware vendors, because some of this is for, as he's pointing out, it may not be just to operate a piece of hardware. It may be top-rated piece of software, like a VPN program. So the problem is, as he's found, is that they have not gotten around to writing a 64-bit version of the kernel extension. I actually have a similar thing. The little clear adapter that I have, the particular one that I have, their connection manager software does not run under the 64-bit kernel. So I have to boot into the 32-bit kernel to use that device. I don't know if you ran into that with your clear device or not. Or if you boot into 64-bit, because I boot into 64-bit on my MacBook Pro.
I do boot into 64-bit on my MacBook Pro. At least I did. I had set it that way. I don't know if 10.6.7 reverted me back to the default or not when I did that update. But I did set it to do that. But the clear device that I use is a standalone hotspot. So it does not require drivers. It just attaches via Wi-Fi.
Okay. Whereas, yeah, this one plugs in via the USB port.
Right. Right.
So... So one thing, now I offered him one suggestion, then I'll answer the performance question. So one thing is that he may want to use the startup mode selector that we've mentioned in the past, rather than fiddling in the terminal, which you could certainly do if you don't mind being in the terminal. But I like the startup mode selector. Plus, the page that you can get it from also goes into a bit more detail about this whole mess. To answer his question about performance, so he says that he received information saying that there's no difference in performance between the 32-bit and 64-bit kernel.
Right.
The answer is you may get better performance.
That's what I understood, too, that depending on how an application or the OS needs to manage memory, it might be faster with 64-bit. Is that right?
Well, I did find a benchmark.
Okay.
So it was a MacPerformanceGuide.com, and it was a group that benchmarked some OS X software. And in several cases, when they ran the same software under the 64-bit kernel,
yep,
they saw the times to accomplish certain tasks were smaller. So,
well, that's good. I mean, it's good that there is yet more efficiency tweaks that we can get out of these machines. That's a good thing.
So what else? So let me see. So he was asking about the kernel, the performance. So he'll get better performance under 64-bit. He may.
Can he still address RAM over 4 gigabytes was one of his questions. And I was going to say I believe, but I also know that answer to be yes. Even if you're booting with a 32-bit kernel, which cannot all on its own address more than 4 gigs, the system will see more than 4 gigs of RAM without any trouble. And this is where it gets very confusing. It's like, well, you know, what is Apple? What are they doing? Why is this? It's a migration path, right? As far as I understand, 10.7 will be all 64-bit, which is why they've now kind of flipped from booting 32-bit kernels on the new machines to 64-bit kernels. But hopefully will allow app developers to address RAM in better ways and more efficient ways. And we can see software run faster and faster and faster.
You know, I can understand why you would think that something that's 32-bit is limited to 4 gigs. Because I'm going to give you one guess. If you took 2 and raised it to the 32nd power, Dave,
then you get 4 gigabytes.
Exactly.
Right.
Now, the good news is that, and you and I have seen this all the way going back to the Apple IIe, in that the physical address space, so the number of bits that the processor can address at once. So this is another little...
This is a great way to explain it. Keep going. Because you just made it that much simpler. Because I always understood this on the Apple IIs, and I, for whatever reason, never applied that same logic here. So keep going. This is good.
Because I think it's similar. So they call it something different. So in the Apple II, they called it page flipping. What they call it on the Intel processor is physical address extension, PAE. I don't think this is a given. I think this is something that the operating system has to support, but the processor can support it.
Okay.
Because if you look back at, and I found a page that described this phenomenon, there are certainly 32-bit operating systems that can see, and as you pointed out, yeah, I mean, it's not just the Mac, Windows, right. A lot of flavors of Windows. If this feature is implemented, then they can see a total of more than 4 gigabytes. Now that leads to the question, well, can they see more than 4 gigabytes at once? And I think the answer to that is no.
That's right.
For a 32-bit system, and let's, so I don't get in trouble here, let's not get too,
yeah,
yeah, too specific about a 32, but as we indicated, 2 to the 32nd is 4 gigabytes.
Right, right.
But if you use something like PAE or page flipping or whatever, you can effectively see a total of more than 4 gigabytes. Though I would still say maybe you cannot see more than 4 gigabytes at once. And I don't know if you'd necessarily need to.
Right. Well, you might. I mean, depends on what you're doing. If you're moving, you know, lots of data around for an image manipulation or something like that, you might.
Yeah, to me, the whole thing is at once. And the other thing is, yeah, virtual memory accomplishes this as well.
Right.
You know, virtual memory gives you a memory space that is much larger than 4 gigabytes, or, right, or has the potential to.
Right.
So
cool.
I think we addressed this.
No, that's good. I hadn't ever heard about that PAE before. That's very interesting. And it was supported initially in the Pentium Pro back in 1995 and has been in every Intel chip since then. Of course, Apple uses Intel chips, so the chip supports it, and Mac OS X, starting with 10.4.4, supports it. So, you know, it unless you're running 10.4.3 or 10.3 on your Mac, you can see more than 4 gigabytes of physical RAM pretty much regardless of what type of processor you have, as long as it's Intel.
I'm going to take an educated guess here, which yeah. could get me, this could get me into trouble. But I think the EFI is also, I think if you have a 32-bit EFI, then that may complicate things, though you may still be able to get away with it. The thing is, I don't have a 32-bit EFI system at my disposal.
I do.
So I couldn't. Oh, you do?
Yeah, I believe the machine we're podcasting on, the iMac, I think it's the iMac 7,1 is what this this model shows okay. up as in system profiler.
How much
profiler.
RAM? How much RAM
I've got 6 gigs of RAM.
Well, that answers that.
Great.
Excellent.
Right.
Wow. Yep. Perfect.
Yep. Cool. All right. Moving to Tyrone. Tyrone has a good question. He wrote, as long as I can pull up his email here. I currently have a 2007 17-inch MacBook Pro. I just ordered the new 27-inch iMac i7 with the 2 GB video card, and I should have it next week. From what I understand, Migration Assistant is the best way to transfer all of my data settings and applications. Is there anything in preparation that I should do before the migration or anything that I can do to make the process run smoothly? And then he also wrote and asked, when I do my migration, should I do it from my MacBook Pro in FireWire target disk mode, or should I do it as from my Time Machine backup? So you want to start with this one, John?
Yeah, we'll hit it back and forth.
Okay.
So my advice was as follows. Is as follows.
Thank you.
So it was and is.
That's right. It is. It your advice defies time.
Timeless.
Okay. It is timeless. That's right.
Here's the absolute first thing I would do before you migrate. Make sure that the drive you're migrating from doesn't have any problems. And I would say at the very least, you want to run a permission repair on that and you want to do a disk repair.
Yeah.
Use the Apple utility, or if you have something a little beefier, because if there's something wrong with the disk, it could at the very least propagate the problem. At the very worst, could bring the whole process crashing down and destroy everything.
Right. Right. That's true. No, that's true. You're going to be accessing a lot of files in a lot of places that you might not regularly touch, and making sure the directory and file system is in good shape before you do that. That's a wise move. I never thought about that before, John. I like that. That's a good thing to do.
I did it especially. Yeah. When I helped my mom migrate from her Motorola machine
yep.
to a new Intel based portable.
Yep.
Cause then I was like, oh man, cause here's the potential for disaster.
Right. Right. Right.
And to further guard against disaster, my suggestion would be make a full backup of the original drive. Again, if everything comes crashing down, you could lose everything. Not
right.
saying it'll happen. It's never happened to me, but it could.
Yep.
So make a full backup, stash it away. Drives are relatively cheap. And, you know, once you're convinced that everything's brought over, then you can use that drive for something else. But I would do a full backup. And then the final thing that I'll offer is find the fastest interface. I think I did make this mistake once. I think when I got my MacBook. I would not do this. I believe you can do this using your wireless interface.
Oh yeah. If you're going over, if you're coming from a backup, like your Time Machine backup, that's right.
Right.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Bad,
bad, bad idea.
Bad idea.
The yeah. current fastest interface on the two machines that he's talking about, the fastest common interface would be, because I think one of the machines he's getting has Thunderbolt.
Right.
But the fastest common interface, I believe, would be gigabit Ethernet.
Yeah, I think that's right. But of course, you can't do gigabit Ethernet in target disk mode.
No, but you can use Migration Assistant will support two machines connected by Ethernet.
Oh, that's true.
That's what I did for when I did my mom's setup. The thing is, one machine supported gigabit. The other, I believe, only supported 100 base T.
Okay.
So it was, but Ethernet was the fastest common interface.
And
so,
it, you just attach to it over the network. I've never done that before.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
It just... I think, yeah, you hooked them up. And I think at some point on one machine, it said, hey, you know, here's a magic number, type it in on the other machine. So you could do some sort of verification.
Yep.
Yeah. So, and you didn't need a cross, you know, like the battle days, it would use a normal Ethernet cable establish a connection between the two machines.
The reason for that. So what John's referring to here is Ethernet uses 4 wires in the way that there are 8 wires in the cable, 4 pairs. Ethernet only uses 2 of those pairs. And one pair is for sending and one pair is for receiving data. If you are plugging two computers into each other, you've plugged send into send and receive into receive, and they won't even see that there's something on the other end. Unless the computers are smart enough. And I believe for the last, not all Macs, but certainly since Intel, and I think before that, Mac's Ethernet ports are what they call auto sensing or auto crossover ports.
Right,
so,
right.
So if they see that you've essentially plugged two computers into each other, one of the ports will flip and then everything works just fine. Normally, of course, Ethernet devices are plugged into a switch or a hub, and the hub automatically is backwards because it knows that that's how it has to work because it's expecting those devices on the other end. So yeah, you can just plug an Ethernet cable between two Macs, and I'm sure thousands of people have done this without even thinking about the fact that it should not work were it not for auto crossover ports. And that's good. You know, that was a pain in the neck. I used to always have to carry what was called a crossover cable, which did exactly what you think it does. It swaps those ports and or swaps those pairs. And I remember I had to build one in the field once because we needed to do it. It was pain.
Oh, nice.
Oh, yeah.
And we're not even going to go back to null modem adapters and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. That's now, good now, stuff, though. Can we? No.
Now, to his last question, though, what's your preference, Dave?
I would do it. I would combine your advice with the speed. So if your fastest connection method is to, you know, if somehow you could do SATA connection, right? Although I guess you can't do SATA target disk mode, right? So that's not going to work. It probably wouldn't matter. I mean, you're going to do it over whatever the fastest drive is. And if you're going from a MacBook Pro, my guess is that your Time Machine backup is going to be your fastest because laptop drives, unless you've done something about this, are notoriously the slowest hard drive you'll ever work with. So I would go from your Time Machine backup just because of speed.
Oh, you know, I hadn't even thought of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Because the drive in the Time Machine, assuming.
Yeah. I don't know what you're using for your Time Machine drive, but unless you got some, you know, portable, you know, USB bus powered, you know, slow as molasses hard drive, it's going to be faster than whatever's in your laptop.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, unless your laptop has an SSD and then, you know, go with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
That's my feeling, because you're going to be moving lots and lots of little files over, which means the drive is going to have to do a ton of seeking around. So, yeah, the faster the drive, the better. So that's my advice there. You know, while we're on this one, John, Eddie had an interesting question about, you know, those new iMacs. I'm real close to buying one and making that my main machine and basically decommissioning my MacBook Pro. So I don't know. We'll have to see. I'm a little scared to not have a laptop as my main machine, but not really. Because we can sync so much now. IMAP and Dropbox and all that stuff. All my stuff is everywhere. So that's what I'm thinking. All right. But anyway, Eddie asks.
Hey, John and Dave. It's Eddie in Tacoma. I had just a quick question about the new iMacs and the Thunderbolt bus. I was wondering, I haven't been able to find anything, if we're going to be able to boot from that bus from an external drive when they become available, which I'm hoping will be relatively quickly. I was just thinking maybe down the road, that might be a nice ability to be able to add an external SSD at reasonable speeds. Anyway, thanks for the show, and this is where you cut me off.
You got it. Right. You made an important point there that we don't have Thunderbolt drives or cables yet. But once we do, yeah, you'll be able to boot from those. No question about it. On both the iMacs that are out now and the MacBook Pros that just came out with the Thunderbolt. Everyone that I've talked to that knows how all this stuff works has confirmed, yeah, it's going to work just fine. So, you know, but that Thunderbolt bus is an interesting thing, John. I know we talked a little bit about it when we first heard about the MacBook Pros that have it, but I like it. It's, you know, it's like having the ability to plug a card into a computer that doesn't have card slots, because you're plugging straight into the bus, and that's a good thing. But essentially straight into the bus. I realize it's, you know.
Yeah, well, it's, yeah. It's what we should have had years ago.
Yeah.
It took this long.
It really, it's true. Well, we sort of had it with the Express Card 34 slot, right? In the MacBook Pros that we have, that was the closest thing that we've had to that. And in fact, that slot, if you have one of those machines, you can put a SATA card in it and make it go faster than the SATA bus internal to your computer if you want. So.
Well, I think it's more that they're combining, kind of like they went from DVI to HDMI.
Right.
It's like, oh, gee, what a great idea to combine video and audio, because if you're consuming one, you're probably consuming the other.
Right, right.
In this case now, it's like, gee, now we can combine display, audio, and peripherals all in one bus.
Yeah, just like we used to do when we built our computers from scratch, right? I mean, even with a Mac Pro, you do that, right? You have a video card, all that stuff is there. You just plug it in. But certainly we did that with our Apple IIs, and anybody that ever built a Windows machine, it was the same way. So
stay in the present, Dave.
That's right. I thought we were supposed to be timeless. All right. We have a couple of questions about waking up network computers, but first, I want to tell you about our third sponsor for the show. It is a new sponsor, John, and it's cool because it actually helps you listen to the show. It is Stitcher. It's available a couple different ways. You can certainly go to Stitcher.com, and if you do, you want to go to Stitcher.com/MGG, and I'll tell you why. But really, it's that MGG you want to remember. Stitcher is an app for basically any mobile device. They support, of course, iOS, both iPhone, iPod, and iPad, and then Android and other platforms as well. So what it does is it allows you to listen on the fly to podcasts. And of course you can subscribe and mark favorites and all that stuff, but there's no syncing. There's no downloading. You just boom, press the button and it's streaming. And I tried it with Matt Geekab, and it works just like I said it works. What they're doing, though, is they want you to try this out. And that's, of course, why they're sponsoring the show, but they're sweetening the pot for you. And that pot is sweetened with an iPad 2. So they're going to give away an iPad 2 this month for one person that registers with the code MGG. One other thing happens when you download the app, and it's free from the App Store. You download the app onto your iOS device, and then you have to sign up. You're going to put your email address, and you got to create a password so that you can log in on multiple devices. When you do that, there is an option to enter a promo code. Enter MGG there. And then that will do two things. As I said, it'll register you for this iPad 2 drawing, but it also will mark Mac Geek Gab as a favorite show and put it in your list automatically. So you don't have to seek us out. We'll automatically be there. So it's something you would want to do anyway, and they save you the step. So, you can check this out. Again, you could go to stitcher.com/MGG, and that'll actually let you enter your email address, which sends you an email that tells you to go and do everything I just told you to do. But it's a nice handy set of instructions. But you can just download it straight to your iOS device and go from there. And it's Stitcher. Again, it's stitcher.com/MGG. So this is going to be cool. We'll be talking about this quite a bit. And there's some other cool things that they're doing too, that we'll tell you about in the future. But for now, just go download it and use MGG as your code, and you'll get us and entered into the drawing. Have you tried out Stitcher yet, John?
The first I saw was, no, I have not.
Okay. All right.
And I'm going to assume I'm not eligible for the,
no, no, you and I are not eligible.
Darn.
That's right.
Oh. Yeah,
but that's good, because it means that, you know, there's that many more or that many less, slots in the pool from which everyone needs to compete.
Okay. But yeah. I'll certainly look at it for consumption of Mac Geek.
Yeah, it's cool. The one thing I really like about it is how easy it is to go through and just select which shows are my favorites. I can do it right from search list. I just tap the little star and it fills up my favorites, but it doesn't download anything. It doesn't fill up the device. I just hit play and it plays. It works the way you'd want it to work. So, all right. Let's go to David here. And David has a question. He says, I have an older Intel Core Duo iMac. I finally got ISSH to work on my iPad, but when the iMac goes to sleep, it will not wake from sleep, even though I have that option set. Okay, so this gets very interesting. Let's start at the beginning. If you go into System Preferences and go into Energy Saver, you can tell it to put the computer to sleep, and you can also say wake for network access. Now, this is a little misleading because what it infers, at least to me on reading this without knowing any better, is that the computer's going to wake up anytime somebody wants to access it over the network. And that, you know, that sounds like what David wants to do.
That's what it says.
Right. That's what it says. And that's not true. Sort of. And hold on to that sort of, because we're going to explain that in a little bit. What this means is wake up when someone sends me a magic packet. And that's not my term. That is the network term. I believe UDP port 9, I think. To the broadcast address of my network and puts my MAC address in it. So even when your computer is, yes, I know that's very confusing. You don't have to worry about it. But it is something that you have to go out of your way to send across any network. It's not going to just wake up when you say, hey, knock, 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 I want access. You have to say, wake up, then knock, knock, I want access. So it's a two-step process. And so when your computer is asleep, the Ethernet port is actually sitting there watching and waiting and listening for this magic packet to come floating across the network. And then it'll you know, start the process of waking the computer up. So in order to get ISSH to wake up your computer or to connect to a sleeping computer, you need to wake it up by sending it one of these magic packets. And I haven't honestly looked. I don't know that there is an app for the iOS that will wake up sleeping devices. There might be, but I haven't looked. I don't know if you've looked, John, for that, or maybe you can search while I'm explaining here. There is a service available from a site called DSL Reports. If you go to dslreports.com/wakeup, that will allow you to wake up a computer, and it actually does it remotely. But you've got to set up your router to forward that port 9 to address 255 on your network, which is the broadcast address. And we can put instructions in the show notes, and we will, for how to do all this. And the DSL Reports explains it pretty well, but it is a convoluted process. However, and I told you, hold on to that thought before, because Apple, in their goal to make everything simply just work, has figured out a way to make this just work. And so if you have an Apple router on your network that is either an Airport Extreme or a Time Capsule, those devices do something a little bit sneaky. And it doesn't have to be your main router. It can just be sitting on the network. Mine works for me, even though my Time Machine or Time Capsule is sitting up in bridge mode. As long as it's on the network, it works. It sits, and anytime a computer comes online and says, I'm making these services available, and you know, remote access is one of them, file sharing is another, printer sharing, the airport router says, okay, I'll make note of that. And then when the computer goes to sleep, it essentially hands that off to the airport router before it goes to sleep. And the airport router keeps broadcasting, kind of masquerading as that computer, saying, yes, this service is available on the network. And when it sees a request come for a service that's on a sleeping computer, guess what it does? It sends out that magic packet and does all the work for you. So as long as you have an Apple router, a newer Apple router on your network, this all works exactly like you would think it would when you check that box. But it take away that Apple router and you're on your own. You've got to go do all the hard work yourself. So that's the not so simple answer to what should have been a simple question, but sometimes it's just not simple. Do you ever do anything with this, John? You probably do and might not even realize it, or maybe you did realize it.
Wake on LAN?
Yeah.
Well, I did when I had my machines. When it was at Macworld, I was using back to my Mac.
Right.
And I was connecting to my brand new Mac Mini. So yes, I've done this.
Cool. Cool.
Yeah. Now, I did find, you said, you know, while you were pontificating.
Yes.
To
No, that was good.
I did find something. It's called iNet WOL.
Okay.
Is a iDevice app from Banana Glue. Love these company names.
Yeah.
which says iNetWL is a wake-up tool for computer connected. English is not their first language. Computer connected by an Ethernet cable to a local network or the internet, and it's in the App Store. So,
okay,
so it looks like somebody's written. There's at least one iApp.
Yeah,
I can call it iApp, right? Yeah, there's at least one iApp that looks to embrace this functionality.
Yeah, so. $2. So, all right, that's cool. That's good. But you might not even need it if you have an Apple router. Chances are, if you wrote us that email, David, it means you don't, or maybe it's not set up in the right way. But there's not a whole lot of wrong ways to do it unless you have it creating its own subnet. But if it's not your main router, put it in bridge mode and that will work. I can attest to that directly. All right. You know, we have another question from Brent. And Brent writes, I have a mid 2007 MacBook Pro running 10.6.7. I would like to use VNC to remote access into my MacBook Pro from my iPhone. I have achieved this over Wi-Fi and 3G using Mocha VNC Lite. The issue is that I would like to sleep my MacBook Pro when not in use. However, my MacBook Pro seems too old to support the Apple Wake on Wireless feature in Snow Leopard. Is there any other alternative to wake my MacBook Pro over Wi-Fi remotely? Okay. So Brent talks about something interesting. And in my example before, I talked about waking up a computer over the Ethernet port, and the Ethernet port sits and listens. Well, I think about 2 years ago, Apple started releasing MacBooks and MacBook Pros that had the ability to be woken up over their wireless network link too. And it works the same way. It's just in this case, the wireless antenna is sitting there kind of watching and waiting and all that good stuff. Unfortunately, and I am one of these people, so I can attest to this, there is no workaround for this if you don't have a machine that had that from the factory. I don't know of any way of having it wake up wirelessly, unless you could do some Bluetooth thing, but it would require some jury rigging, I think. But you might be able to do it with Bluetooth, you know, set up a device that acts as a mouse click or something, but you'd have, I don't think there's going to be any, I don't think anybody's done this yet. So it would require you need a soldering iron and Xcode to make this work, but you could, right. With Bluetooth, as long as you're within range. That's my feeling on that.
Go for it.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Could be fun. Weekend project.
But to summarize, it's definitely a function of the network adapter. If it's not the network adapter, then
right.
There's no way around it. Right. That's the first device that has to have the capability.
That's right. That's right. All right. So we have a couple things from 328 to go through. Our last show, we talked about batch renaming files, and we got a couple of emails. Mark was the first one to send in and say that Graphic Converter will actually do this. If you go to File, Convert and Modify under the function dropdown is the rename option to navigate to and locate files. And you change one of the panels and away it goes. So he says that the Graphic Converter can do that. Brandon wrote and said that a piece of software called Name Changer by MRR Software does this. He said Name Changer helps you rename a list of files quickly and easily, and you can see the changes as you type. So and it can change names based on different criteria and all that good stuff. So one of those two might be a nice little simple solution to the renaming issue we talked about in 328. So thank you very much to everyone, including Mark and Brandon, but certainly not just Mark and Brandon, for sending that in. Time for cool stuff found, John, before we blast out of here for the day.
Cool.
James writes, I face the issue of wired versus wireless access on the road, and I make sure that I have the ability to connect to either when I travel. I have occasional issues with Apple's inconsistencies in interface here and there. One is how ridiculously hard it is to play all podcasts sequentially on a Nano, but that's another show. And the inability to access the Airport Express via a web interface or at least an iOS app. Though, as you all duly pointed out in the last podcast, you can set it ahead of time at home. There are occasions where this is insufficient for the occasion or simply doesn't work. Airport Extreme simply doesn't give enough information to the user. All it took for me was one blinking yellow light on the road to consider other options. I chose the Ingenious Travel Router for $50. You get a full-featured N router, which is roughly the same size as the Airport Express, with a fully accessible web interface. For half the price of the AE, you can accommodate all your routery needs. It doesn't share my iTunes library, but you know, I really never use that feature on the road anyway. So there you go. The Ingenious Travel Router. It's $50. We'll send a link into the show notes there, John. Good, right?
Awesome.
All right. Robert Wright. Go ahead. Go.
Well, I'm just saying that's one thing. Apple, couldn't they put
an app?
A little checkbox saying, you know, enable port 80 access or web access to
play. Yeah, but then they'd have to build that interface and support it.
Yeah.
I know. They're the only people that make us do this with software. I know.
Well, it just makes it proprietary. That's the other thing that's kind of a downer.
Yeah. Yeah, those routers are clearly not intended to be used with anything other than Macs.
Well, don't they make a Windows version of the utility?
They do, but
I thought they did.
Yeah.
Still, you shouldn't need a piece of...
No.
Yeah, like almost every other one on the planet. Yeah, you can access it through a web interface.
Yeah. My guess is they'll change that at some point. They have to.
Mm-hmm.
Robert writes... I found this amazing wide-angle magnetic lens for the iPhone. You stick a small metal ring to the iPhone, and then the lens just magnetically snaps on. It also works as a macro lens. The ring covers the iPhone flash, but that's easily fixed with two snaps of a wire cutter. It's from photojojo.com. And, I meant to pop up the price, but I'll find it now. It's $40 for both the fisheye wide-angle and macro lens. Because you can turn one around.
Hmm.
Yeah. And either one is like $25. So yeah, it's cool. I could see that being somewhat valuable, especially for, $20, $25. John, you have a cool stuff found item to throw in this week?
I do.
Go.
So just finished up an article today and I needed to do some visual HTML editing.
Okay.
And I won't go into the gory details, but I needed to. And, for some things, I'm cool with BB Edit. It's great for doing HTML editing if you know the tags. In this case, what I had to do was some table work. And I didn't want to learn the HTML tags to do a table. So I'm like, oh, man, So I had the original HTML of the table that I wanted to change. But I didn't want to learn the tags. So I went looking around for inexpensive, aka free, visual HTML editor. And I found one. Actually, I found the updated version of one that I had found in the past. And it's called Composer.
Okay.
Spelled KOMPOZER.
Because that's a cool way to spell it.
Yeah, and maybe it avoids getting lost in the shuffle. And I think it has some open source roots here.
Okay.
But it's free. You can certainly download. Oh, obviously, powered by Mozilla. So I think it has some Mozilla components. But it does what it says. So I took my HTML, pasted it into this, then switched it to visual mode. It showed me the table. And then I was able to highlight a column and then resize. It showed me a little thing showing how many pixels wide a column was. And I'm like, oh, this is perfect.
Oh, wow.
Fix that. Then I think it allowed me to do centering of some of the content, then move over to another column. And then once I was done, I went back to the HTML view, copied all the HTML and pasted it into our publishing system to wrap up a review that I just published today for a hard drive. So that was great because... I didn't want to review my HTML table codes.
That's smart because it's easy to forget to do things like setting the border to zero and then you wind up with a table that looks like a 4-year-old made it, and it's got all these big thick borders
And unfortunately the options, I did a quick search online to look for visual editors and the problem is most of them are pretty high end packages.
Right.
And they cost money.
Right.
I needed something quick, dirty, and free.
Perfect.
Well, I think I will toss them a few bucks because it got me out of a fix and I was able to publish quickly.
Yeah, it looks to be open source, but they do accept donations. So that's a beautiful thing. All right.
Something new, Dave. Can I talk about our new thing?
Yeah, if you want to contact us, there is a new option, and that is...
And there's a new option. So thanks to people that jumped on this. So we now have a Facebook page. And thanks. So we just published the news today on the Mac Geek Gab Twitter feed. And by the time the show rolled around, Dave, we had enough people to give us our own page. So if you want to go to our Facebook page, it's at facebook.com/MacGeekGab.
Hey, that's easy to remember.
Yeah. You have to have a certain number of people that like you or fans, yep. And they just piled on the site and gave us the requisite number so we could get that. You can't, yeah, normally you can't do that. You need enough people. So thank you all the people that like the page. And
awesome.
We already have a few wall posts, and you and I, Dave, will figure out what to put on the site.
Yeah. We'll keep it up to date for you, that's for sure. And we'll certainly post when new shows are out, and probably, you know, it'll be a good place for us to put some pictures and things like that too. So you can go and like it and subscribe and all that good stuff. You can also send us an email if you want to feedback@macgeekgab.com.
I believe, Dave, that you said feedback@macgeekgab.com.
That's feedback@macgeekgab.com. You can also call us at 206-666-GEEK, which is
4335.
That's right. And you can Skype us to MacGeekGab. And John, you mentioned Twitter. So on Twitter, you are John F. Braun. I am Dave Hamilton. The show is MacGeekGab. Pete is Pilot Pete. And Mac Observer is Mac Observer, all twitter.com/all that stuff. So check us out there. Twitter's a fun place too. It's a great way for us all to stay in touch with each other, and we like that.
Yeah, I'm usually hanging there. You are too.
Yeah. I want to thank Michael Johnston from the We Have Communicators podcast. Great show, formerly the iPhone Alley podcast, and he does a great job over there. He also converts this to AAC for us and for you. Cashfly provides all the bandwidth for cashfly.com. The podcast marketplace includes the A5 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, Yojimbo from Barebone Software, PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro from Smile, Notebook from Circus Ponies, and Stitcher with the coupon code or promo code MGG or stitcher.com/MGG, all through Backbeat Media. And that brings us to the end of this show. We'll be back on Thursday for MacGeekGab 330 premium show, and then back on Monday for 331 here in the standard feed. Got anything to add, John?
I'm pooped.
Well...